welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, I'll be interviewing Tara Culp Ressler about the surge of transvaginal ultrasound bills in the States. Also, more on the reaction to the contraception mandate clarification, and a segment on why it's important not to victim blame Rihanna. Lacey Green has a video out chronicling what life was like before Roe v. Wade.
Because at the time, one in five maternal deaths were the result of an illegal, unsafe abortion. The statistics, as well as the personal stories of women who are now grandmothers, tell tales of injury, hardship, and even death as they sought out illegal reproductive health care in an earlier time.
I couldn't have that baby, because if I did, and I died, who would take care of the little baby I had? And so I asked the young woman where I worked, and they sent me to a woman, and she put, I think it was a strip of slippery elm bark up my uterus. 2 days later, I had a screaming fever, and I was in such pain. And so I went back out to see this woman, and she said, I told you not to come back. And I said, I have nowhere else to go.
She also recounts how class determined back then how safe an abortion was that you could get, with privileged women getting quiet abortions from doctors and poor women going to back alley providers. So last week, I reported on the newly clarified HHS regulations regarding contraception, which laid out how the administration plans to make sure that nearly all women will have their contraception covered by their insurance, while carving out exceptions so nonprofit religious organizations don't have to pay for it directly if they don't want to. The nonprofits were hiding behind the moral taint of having to pay for non-procreative sex, even though the benefits are earned benefits held by the employees, meaning that the groups were not paying for them so much as the employees were. I argue that the Catholic authorities, especially the Conference of Catholic Bishops, would reject this clarification for one simple reason. This was never about religious liberty, moral taint, or money. It was about separating women from their contraception, and any policy that addressed their stated concerns about money but allowed women to access contraception through insurance would be rejected. I was right, according to the new report by NPR. They explained how much religious entities are not being required to pay for contraception.
And the latest last week proposed to make it clear, first, that churches themselves will be exempt, and second, that religious schools, hospitals, and charities who hire people of multiple faiths have insurance companies provide the contraceptive coverage separately through a very complicated and convoluted mechanism that would basically keep the religious entities out of having to pay for or arrange or even be involved in it in any way.
So this must be very, very clear by now. They are not paying for contraception. They weren't in the first place, but now they've got so much distance between their healthcare dollars and the eventual use of contraception that the claim that they're going to get some slut taint by women spending their earned healthcare dollars the employer released to them is even more ridiculous. There is simply no way on God's green earth that this is about religious liberty, except insofar as employers want to deprive their employees of religious liberty to choose their own contraception. So that leaves only one remaining objection, which is that if they believe that if you work for them, they get to have a vote in your private reproductive and sexual decisions. And now they're basically admitting that.
A lengthy statement issued today by the Conference of Catholic Bishops President Cardinal Timothy Dolan said, quote, it shows some movement but falls short of addressing the U.S. bishops' concerns.
So what in particular do they still find troubling?
Several things. A big one, and this will come as a big disappointment to the administration, is this very complicated way of trying to spare religious hospitals and universities from being involved in providing contraceptive coverage. It turns out the bishops don't even like the idea of those employees automatically having that coverage, even if those entities don't have to provide it. The bishops seem to want an explicit opt-out for employees and or their children.
In other words, they simply believe they get veto power over how employees spend their compensation. If they could find an easy legal way to prevent employees from spending their checks on contraception, they'd clearly try for that too. But in the meantime, they're going to force you to pay twice over for your contraception. Once when you earned it by working, and again because they want to force you not to use your earned benefits on contraception. And yes, I mean twice. since the insurance you're paying for with your cash and your labor covers contraception. By forcing the insurance companies not to cover you, they are forcing you to pay for a benefit that you will be forced not to receive. Lots of force to force their religious beliefs on you. The opt-out thing is clearly some political nonsense set up to imply people are required to use contraception if they don't want to. There's already an opt-out clause. If you don't want to use contraception, you opt out simply by not getting a prescription for it. Easy. That this is about giving employers control over employees was also made clear by this.
The bishops are also sticking up for religious owners of for-profit companies, which they correctly point out these rules don't make any allowance for. There are currently a couple of dozen lawsuits where the owners of everything from arts and crafts stores to heating and cooling firms are suing the government because the owners say having to provide the contraceptive coverage violates the owners' religious beliefs.
So they're saying that secular employers should be able to withhold benefits earned by employees because they disapprove of their employees' sex lives. This has nothing to do with religion, except the word is being tossed around a lot to confuse the issue. This is about a bunch of misogynist employers who think, because you work for them, your sexual and reproductive lives belong to them. If they get their way on this, they will absolutely look for new avenues to meddle with your private life, because this is about power and control, and not religion. I'd like to welcome Tara Culp Ressler to the program. Tara is a reporter blogger at thinkprogress.org who writes frequently about healthcare issues. She did a great roundup recently of the way that invasive and unnecessary transvaginal ultrasound requirements to get abortions are creeping back into the state laws, and she's here today to talk about it. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Tara.
Thanks so much for having me, Amanda. It's great to be here.
So last year, Virginia lawmakers were embarrassed nationwide when it was discovered they wanted to require women to undergo a transvaginal ultrasound that is medically unnecessary in order to get an abortion. What happened to that bill after the national outcry? Can you kind of summarize that?
Sure. So basically, you know, after Virginia proposed this ultrasound bill, you know, it was last year sort of right around the height of what women's health advocates started calling the war on women. So there was already a lot of outrage going on about, you know, just kind of all of these really horrible, restrictive anti-choice measures that Republicans, mainly Republican men, were pushing. And this idea of a transvaginal probe really became sort of the ultimate symbol of that war on women. And, you know, understandably, people were outraged. People started referring to it as state-sponsored rape, just the idea that a woman could be penetrated against her will simply because a male Republican lawmaker decided that he wanted her to be. And so there were massive protests, massive outcry, and the legislators ultimately backtracked off of that language. And they did end up passing a forced ultrasound bill, but they removed the transvaginal provision. So it was kind of, you know, your garden variety forced ultrasound bill that we see in states across the country.
What's interesting is it never really was specifically requiring a transvaginal ultrasound, though it was a transvaginal ultrasound was just a product of the actual requirements. Can you kind of explain why that would be?
Right, sure. So the thing about ultrasound bills that I think, you know, that the case of Virginia really brought to the forefront is that, you know, pretty much every forced ultrasound bill is a transvaginal ultrasound bill. And that's because before 12 weeks of pregnancy, your, you know, typical abdominal ultrasound, which is obviously much less invasive, it doesn't work as well. It doesn't give you as clear of an image. It doesn't allow you to hear the fetal heartbeat as clearly. And so, you know, these invasive transvaginal probes are really, you know, that's the only way to do an ultrasound. If you're, you know, if you have a woman in her first 12 weeks of pregnancy trying to get an abortion, you know, which is obviously the majority of women, 90% of women get abortions in the first trimester. And so, you know, Virginia was kind of the first instance when people, when that started clicking for people and when they started realizing, oh, you know, we're talking about this scary transvaginal probe. You know, we're not talking about this ultrasound where you're putting, you know, jelly on a woman's abdomen, you know, this is a whole different beast. But you know, actually, even though, you know, Virginia lawmakers kind of got embarrassed by that controversy and walked back their language a little bit, you know, that ultrasound bill is still in place for the women of Virginia who are seeking abortions. And that means that the women who are seeking abortions very early on in their pregnancies are still undergoing that transvaginal probe. And I think kind of after the controversy around passing that legislation died away, I think people kind of forgot that point that, you know, just because we shamed them about the word transvaginal, that doesn't mean these procedures aren't still happening.
So one of the things that I think is interesting is that they usually do an ultrasound for an abortion anyway. Why is this mandatory one different?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, mandatory ultrasounds, you know, it's ultimately about taking away a woman's consent. It's about forcing a woman to undergo a medical procedure that she may not actually have elected to have, that she may not want to have. You know, and ultrasounds are common, but they're not medically necessary in the first trimester of abortion. In the first trimester of pregnancy, women seeking an abortion in the first trimester of pregnancy, you know, they're not medically required to have this ultrasound procedure. And so, you know, it's really just yet another way for anti-choice legislators to wedge themselves in between women and their doctors. This is a conversation and a decision that women and medical professionals need to be having, not, you know, a state-mandated requirement passed down from these anti-choice lawmakers who have nothing to do with a woman's in-person medical care.
So Virginia changed their language, but now we're seeing these kinds of laws crop up in a number of states. Can you kind of talk about that?
Sure. So, yeah, Virginia changed its language, and, you know, we're kind of seeing other things pop up in other states that are mandating, you know, first of all, forced ultrasound bills, but also some bills that aren't even about ultrasounds whatsoever. You know, if you dig a little bit closer into what these requirements will actually mean for women seeking abortions, you figure out, oh, hey, you know, this is going to have the unintended consequence of mandating a transvaginal ultrasound. And a good example of that is in Arkansas, where you've got a Republican state senator who is trying his hardest to advance, you know, it's called a fetal heartbeat ban. So he wants to outlaw abortion at any point after a fetal heartbeat can be detected. You know, that can be detected as early as 6 weeks of pregnancy. But in order to figure out that early on in a pregnancy, if there is a fetal heartbeat, you have to do an ultrasound. And if you're doing an ultrasound that early on in a pregnancy, it's got to be a transvaginal ultrasound. So after he proposed that bill at the end of January, women's health advocates started saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, if you're making women go to their doctors to figure out whether there's a fetal heartbeat, you know, as early as 6 weeks into pregnancy, you're ultimately making women go to their doctors to have an invasive transvaginal ultrasound. That's a consequence of your bill. It was kind of a similar situation as Virginia after sort of outcry over that, after people started messaging it that way, you know, this heartbeat bill is actually a transvaginal ultrasound bill. He actually walked that back and amended his legislation. So, you know, it's no longer banning it after a fetal heartbeat can be detected. It's specifically banning it after a fetal heartbeat can be detected by using an abdominal ultrasound. So that pushes the deadline back to about 12 weeks of pregnancy and makes sure that, you know, women in the very first weeks of their pregnancy aren't going to have to undergo a state-mandated vaginal probe. So that's one example where, you know, that legislation didn't have anything to do with ultrasounds explicitly, but, you know, kind of implicitly in all of the ways that they were actually going to affect women in the state, you know, it was all about transvaginal ultrasounds, and he walks that back. Another example of that is in Michigan, where, you know, we recently had an outcry that was also very similar to Virginia, where lawmakers proposed a kind of very specifically worded ultrasound bill. It didn't necessarily mention vaginal probes, but it did stipulate that, you know, all of these mandatory ultrasounds that women had to undergo, they had to use the most modern equipment available. They had to provide the most clearly visible image, and the most audible fetal heartbeat possible. you know, and that's ultimately, that's describing a transvaginal ultrasound. As I mentioned before, they, you know, they give you clearer images and they give you clearer sound bites than, you know, than using the less invasive abdominal procedure. So after people figure that out, oh, hey, this bill, you know, this is really a transvaginal ultrasound bill in practice, even if not in name, there's a massive outcry, and the Michigan Republicans actually, you know, walked that back. They stipulated, you know, we're not in the business of making any women undergo forced transvaginal ultrasounds. We won't pass any legislation that requires women to do so. You know, ultimately, it's unclear whether they're actually going to end up passing an amended version of their ultrasound bill, just removing that part of the language. But yeah, you know, after people dig a little bit under the surface and, you know, figure out the actual implications of this legislation, they don't like what they're seeing.
So one of the things that's interesting to me is that the research shows that women who get ultrasounds don't change their minds. With that in mind, it can't be that they're actually trying to change anybody's mind. So what is the appeal of forcing women to get ultrasounds?
You know, it seems like a fairly callous anti-choice tactic to shame women into regretting their decision to have an abortion. You know, that's what so much of these, you know, these sort of forced counseling laws, all of the requirements that doctors need to be giving women detailed information about the stages of development of their fetus, you know, ensure that women are physically looking at the ultrasound and the picture of the fetus. You know, it's really, this is emotional bullying. You know, these are just tactics that are designed to make women feel bad about the choice that they're making. You know, it's supposed to remind you, this is a child and this is life, and, you know, you're making this horrible, immoral decision. You know, which is really just, you know, at the heart of it, that's really just a horrible thing to make a woman go through. You know, they don't have any idea what the circumstances under which these women are choosing to have abortions, but their ultimate goal is to make every single woman feel bad about that choice she's making for herself.
So why are we not seeing the same national outcry that we did when it came to Virginia?
You know, I've been thinking a lot about that and trying to think about how Think Progress specifically as you know, a political blog can help move that conversation forward and incite some of that same outrage. Because I don't completely know the answer to that question. I do think that, you know, obviously these bills are horrible. They clearly strike a nerve with people. And, you know, people who maybe typically wouldn't even be so up in arms about the reproductive rights movement react in a very visceral way when they start thinking about these transvaginal probes. So I wonder if the women's health community just isn't messaging this enough, isn't driving the point home that, you know, this is a forced ultrasound bill, but it's also a transvaginal ultrasound bill. You know, I think maybe these bills are slipping underneath the surface because they are complicated and the language is buried in there. And unless you know, are really digging around in the nitty gritty of this proposed bill that Michigan brought forth, you know, you may miss these clauses. You may not realize it. And I think it's really up to the activists who are working in this space to try to figure out some kind of strategy. And, you know, and I definitely don't totally know the answers to this, but some kind of strategy to further this conversation so we can keep bringing this up and keep bringing it to people's attention, keep saying, hey, wait a second, you know, there's a transvaginal probe lurking in this. Aren't you so angry about this? Aren't we outraged? You know, it's hard in the beginning of this 2013 legislative session to figure out how to carry through this momentum of last spring's war on women. It feels kind of like we need a new message and a new way to think about this anti-abortion, anti-choice, anti-woman push from the Republican end, and I'm not quite sure what that looks like yet.
My guest today has been Tara Culp-Resler, and you can follow her work at thinkprogress.org. She writes in the health section mainly. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Tara.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great.
Awesome work. So, Rihanna has gotten back together with Chris Brown. I feel almost bad recapping the whole story, since even those of you who have never heard a song by either of them probably know the story. But in case you haven't, here goes. 4 years ago, at a pre-Grammy party, the two, who were dating, got into a fight in the car. During this fight, according to the Los Angeles police report, Brown tried to force Rihanna out of a moving vehicle, but deterred by her seatbelt, he shoved her head against a passenger window, punched her in the eye with his left hand, and then kept driving while punching with his right hand. She was sent to the hospital with a swollen, bruised, and bleeding face. She broke up with him shortly thereafter, but for the past year or so has been teasing out a reconciliation. First calling him a friend, then doing a song with him, then taking pictures of him in her bed, and now this.
So after months of speculation, Chris Brown and Rihanna confirmed their rekindled romance at the Grammy Awards last night, while also fueling rumors of an engagement, with Rihanna sporting a large diamond ring on her left hand. The on-off couple sat together throughout this year's Grammy ceremony, with Rihanna occasionally snuggling up to her beau, who happily wrapped his arms around her, confirming that they are indeed a couple after months of speculation. However, it was the large diamond sparkler on Rihanna's ring finger that caused a storm on Twitter, with viewers speculating whether Chris Brown had proposed to the Bajan songstress 4 years after they first split.
Showing up and canoodling at the Grammys is an overt act of symbolism of the absolute creepiest kind, because both of them missed the 2009 Grammys because of the beating. Indeed, one can imagine what a power trip it must have been for an abusive man like Brown to get his victim to snuggle with him at a party that he forced her to miss because her injuries at his hands were that bad. That kind of symbolic domination is exactly the kind of thing that abusers love, because it makes them feel that they have total control over their victim. Indeed, this is far from the only public display of Rihanna's devotion to Brown, a devotion that is publicly being displayed in such a way as to draw attention to the beating and how much she supposedly doesn't seem to hold him accountable for it.
Singer Chris Brown appeared in a Los Angeles courtroom just minutes ago for a probation hearing. Prosecutors claim that Brown violated his probation after his 2009 attack on Rihanna. Rihanna was actually in the front row of the courtroom, and she even blew him a kiss as he walked in. Prosecutors are asking to have Brown's probation revoked for lack of evidence that he completed his 180 days of community service.
There are two ways to deal with seeing something as upsetting as a woman who has been the victim of such serious abuse completely forgive and try to exonerate the man who beat her. There's the way I prefer, which is to use this opportunity to educate yourself and others about the realities of domestic violence and how the abusers manipulate and guilt trip their victims until the victims are suffering from low self-esteem and feel that only the abuser can validate them. Often an abuser will tell his victim that he's the only one who really understands her, and that everyone else just doesn't understand their love, and that she should therefore trust him and treat everyone else like the enemy. The displays of affection that would seem over the top even for a non-abusive couple are part of this whole thing of creating the illusion that it's an abuser and his victim against the world. For victims, getting away from the emotionally warped world the abuser has created for them is incredibly hard to do, which is why victims usually return a number of times before escaping, and why prosecutors usually have to create cases against abusers knowing the victims will resist attempts to put their abusers in jail. Or you could just blame the victim and pretend that's feminism, which is what Lena Dunham did on Alec Baldwin's show.
Yeah. 1% of your audience, 1%,
yeah,
is genuinely and in any way influenced by what you do and say. That's still tens of thousands of people.
It's amazing. It's an amazing thing, and it's like, it's a platform that you have to take seriously, which is why sometimes it's like, I used to be really into Rihanna, that pop star, and then it's like, again, I don't want to ever, you know, throw stones from my glass house, but I follow her on Instagram, and I just think about how many little girls, beyond what I could even comprehend, are obsessed with Rihanna. Like, you know, she left Barbados. She's had this amazing career. She's, you know, won Grammys. She's talented.
Yeah.
And then she gets back together with Chris Brown and posts a million pictures of them smoking marijuana together on a bed. And it cracks my heart in half in a way that makes me feel like I'm 95 years old.
Because you want to be Chris Brown smoking pot?
No, because she got back together with someone.
No, I know.
Oh, yeah,
exactly.
You made a really good joke and I got too emotional in my response. Yeah, because I want to be
You're
in
so
a bed.
Sincere.
It's terrible.
You're not mean enough.
It's terrible.
No, but it's...
This was really disappointing to me because Dunham's show Girls has shown a remarkably nuanced understanding of how women are socialized to defer to men and how women who judge other women for it are often themselves deferring to some man who is power tripping over them. While none of her characters are being beaten, she often shows them putting up with men stepping all over their boundaries and manipulating them, and doing so precisely because women are trained from the cradle to defer to male authority. Abuse victims stay with their abusers for the same reason that the characters on Girls stay with men who deliberately play mind games with them or stay with men who, as in one episode, lock them in an inescapable room full of horrible images for hours while calling it art, or stay with men who are clear that they will treat you like masturbation toys instead of a partner in bed. Because women are told over and over again in a multitude of ways that if we stand up for ourselves, we'll be shrewish bitches and no one will ever love us again. In fact, abusers often tell victims no one else will ever love them again. And because our society is so hateful to women, it's easy for victims to fall for this line. Which is why blaming Rihanna is such a bad idea. You are telling her and every abuse victim overhearing it that you agree with the abuser that the victim is bad and unworthy of love, which in turn makes it hard for the victim to leave because she sees you shaking your head at her and thinks, gosh, he's right that everyone else hates me and he's the only shot at love I'll ever have. It's also worth remembering that the man interviewing Dunham was the same guy who left this message for his daughter on her voicemail.
I am going to get on a plane, and I'm going to come out there for the day, and I'm going to straighten your ass out when I see you. Do you understand me? I'm going to really make sure you get it. Then I'm going to get on a plane, and I'm going to turn around, and I'm going to come home. So you better be ready Friday, the 20th, to meet with me. So I'm going to let you know just how I feel about what a rude little pig you really are. You are a rude, thoughtless little pig, okay?
Now, calling a 12-year-old girl a pig because she doesn't want to talk to you, and gosh, it's hard to see why. It's not the same thing as beating your girlfriend to a pulp. But it's still abusive nonsense. I don't judge Dunham for doing the interview instead of refusing because of some ambiguous duty to be a role model. We all make our compromises. But she should be more forgiving of the fact that the choice to leave an abusive boyfriend is a lot harder than the choice to boycott an interviewer that is known to call his daughter a pig. And consider that before she starts throwing stones. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. Oh boy, it's prom time again. And prom planning means, inevitably, people who want to use the prom as a chance to exclude and bully gay kids. In this case, it's an Indiana high school that has a group trying to plan a separate prom that excludes gay kids. Here's one teacher defending it by saying gays have no purpose in life.
You know, if a gay person, do you consider them maybe they have some sort of purpose in life? Do you think it's just a...
I don't. I personally don't. I'm sorry. I don't understand it. A gay student or adult or person isn't going to come up and make some change unless it's because they realize, you know what, it was a choice and I'm choosing God.
How someone can be a teacher and so cruel to their students is beyond me. I will say it's funny that people are claiming to do this out of Christian concerns about immorality, because all the fornicating and drinking that straight students do at prom is apparently super moral, as long as it's straight people.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.